Welcome to the Farcast, bringing you insights into Wall Street, Washington, and the world. And now here's your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr. Thanks so much for joining us again this week. It is the 14th day of December. Here we are, a couple of weeks left only until the end of the year, and we're going to be writing 2024 on our checks before you know it, for those of us old fogies who still write checks. I'm not sure if anybody writes checks anymore. Hell, I still carry cash in my wallet, and I know that makes me very anachronistic. Well, time seems at moments to be passing me by, but certainly not in the stock market. Whoa, new highs, 37,000 on the Dow. That's big, folks. It's not big in terms of a percentage gain, but it is in terms of psychology. And it should be a great reason to celebrate the success of the American economy. It's a benchmark. It's a flag we can fly and say, look, this works, world. The rest of you want to throw rocks at the United States. You want to criticize America. Well, take that in your pipe and smoke it. 37,000 on the Dow. Through difficult times and pandemic and everything else and fighting inflation, the U.S. economy continues to expand. And this experiment in democracy and capitalism continues to prove itself successful. It's messy. It's ugly. There are parts of it that really do stop to make you take pause, particularly when you're watching what's going on in Washington, D.C. And yet it continues to work, and we continue to flourish and thrive. Jay Powell, chairman of the Federal Reserve, spoke yesterday, reported for the Fed. He said that they've been fighting inflation on two fronts. One was a supply chain issue. One was a demand issue. The supply chain issue has helped correct, add to supply. That's taken pressure off of prices. And they've also, by raising rates, reduced demand. Inflation is coming down. We're also seeing GDP estimates for growth come down, significantly lower for next year. 1.something%, 1.25%, 1.5%, something like that. That's down a lot from the past couple of years. So 1.25%, they think they're going to lower rates three times in 2024 and then more in 2025 and perhaps even into 2026. This slow roll will take us back down to that 2% range for Fed funds rates, according to some Fed reporters. That seems awfully low to me. And yet here we are below 4% this morning as we begin. Markets loved it yesterday. You show markets cheaper money. You show markets cheaper money. And that means that prospective earnings, as we look out, means borrowing costs drop. That means the housing market starts to pick up. That means refinancing for all these corporations where we were worried because they had this 3% bonds on their books and we're going to have to refinance at 6 or 7%. Well, maybe it's going to be lower, and maybe we can increase those earnings estimates. Earnings, as my friend Larry Kudlow says, are the mother's milk of stock prices over time. That's a good line. I've always liked it. Always fun to be with Larry, too. But yeah, pay attention to the earnings, folks. Balance sheets matter, too. Who's gotten this right? Who figured this out? Who said, if we see the technical charts start to move higher, I'm going to buy this. If it breaks here, I'm going to buy it. The answer, ding, 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 is Jim Urio from TJM Institutional Services, our buddy in Chicago on the CBOE. Good morning, Jim, and welcome back, and congratulations for being brilliant.
Thank you, Michael. Well, what you just said, which is really interesting to me, is that, like, even when we had that discussion about when it settles above here, to me, it's a buy signal momentum. Oftentimes, what the market's doing, the price of the market, interferes and disagrees with what I was thinking. Because at the time, even a month ago, was thinking, well, think that it seems like rates are too high. It seems like it's going to choke off the economy at some point in time. I'm not sure why we want to buy the stock market, but the stock market seems to have this momentum behind it. But then the answer comes later. The answer is the Fed pivot. And I like all the things you said about people underestimating the American economy. And I'm with you on that. The one thing I will push back just a tiny bit is that when you boil everything else away, what the market is saying, and you mentioned this, but I'm going to underscore, is that they really love cheaper money. Yes. That bums me out a tiny bit that we have this such a reaction function, right? Okay, we need cheap money.
Yeah, it's Pavlovian. We've got the Fed driving the markets instead of the fundamentals driving the market. I mean, the fundamentals get there sooner or later, but we're reacting to the Fed.
Yeah, and that's what I don't love. And there's going to come a time, I don't think it's going to be this time, when the market is going to be like, because there's a way to look at it if you tilt your head and say, okay, what Jay Powell's saying is that the economy is slowing. You mentioned GDP estimates coming down considerably, and it's time to start to move back, you know, to a level that supports the economy. To say it that way is fine. But if you're saying that he sees potentially burning timbers falling from the ceiling and has to come with the fire hose and lower rates, that perhaps that's not as good.
Well, and he's not saying he's seeing any of those. He's saying actually that they've engineered a soft landing. If he pulls this off the way he says he's going to lower rates perhaps through 2026, that would be a very slow roll, very modest, moderate. He's got to expect these spikes like we saw yesterday, and looks like we'll have some follow through here today, depending on the economic data. Today, Bank of England left their rates unchanged and said they're going to leave them where they are for a very long time. That's breaking news out this morning. We've got more economic data today. So this, in spite, I guess, if we don't have huge disruptions, he's got to be willing to let these market spikes, right? They've got to be part of his, got to be part of his calculus that they're going to happen. You got to let them go sideways for a while, and then we'll take a look at the inflation data later. So that, if I'm seeing this right, argues for a stair-step pattern higher over the course of the year, except for that one thing. The rate hikes they've had so far, Jim, have slowed the economy, and there are still a huge number of economists saying we could still go into recession, the recession that's never happened. What do you make of that?
I agree. I believe we are going into recession. Yes, I've been wrong for two quarters, possibly three.
And oh, hell, I've been wrong for 2 years.
Right, 2 years. Okay.
I've been calling for a recession. It feels like 2 years, probably not. But I mean, when the Fed started that rate hiking cycle in March and then started spiking up to half a point, you know, and three quarters of a point hikes, geez, I mean, how could you not have a recession? And the yield curve's been inverted. I can't even remember when we had a normal yield curve.
It's been so long. Now, you said, how can you not have a recession when they raise rates so quickly? I think the answer is in how quickly they raise rates, and you marry that to the fact that the 5 years prior to the rate hiking cycle, U.S. 10-year yields averaged 1.96%, an historically low 1.96%. What I'm getting at is that everybody had an opportunity to what we like to call roll into duration. What I mean by that is just picture one mortgage holder. You know this, I'm explaining that to them, but one mortgage holder going, oh, I can get a 2.5% on the third year. I'll take that. So now they're insulated from the bad effect. Now, to put a finer point on that, in 2019, there was 1% of people who had mortgages under 3%. By 2021, 19% of the mortgages are being held or under 3%. Now, the point I'm trying to make is that—
give me those numbers again. In 2019, what?
There was only 1% of the whole mortgages outstanding in the United States were under 3%.
Okay.
By 2021, almost 30% of the mortgages were under 3%.
Wow. Wow.
So people rolled in, people took advantage of cheap money. There was no reason not to. When you can get a 2.5% 30-year mortgage, you take it. So tons of people did. So to put that in perspective too, like we said, oh, your mortgage rates went up to 8%. Well, the effective rate, the people that what we're actually paying in this country was about 3.8% was the average mortgages. Meaning the fact that rates went up so high so quickly, all that did was choke up the normal reaction function, the normal transactions that are happening in the housing market, and choke the supply a little bit. My whole point, I'm sorry if I bored anybody to death there. My whole point is that the rate hikes didn't have the same efficacy over the time period they've been allowed to as they could have in other situations if they were brought up slower and they started early. So my belief is
that's a great point. That's a really good point. Really good point, folks.
And do you think I explained it enough, or is it felt like I was rambling there a little bit?
Well, so basically, this rate hike pattern term has happened so quickly, it hasn't had the effect to get into the consumer's wallet the same way it would have if it had lasted longer. consumers haven't been forced to refinance. They haven't moved as much. They haven't taken new mortgages because it's been such a short period. A longer period at these higher rates would see people continue to ratchet up, but it's already started to turn. So I think it's an excellent point, Jim. Excellent point.
Okay, good. Now, but the thing is that I think is interesting is that I think on the other side of the coin, we could see efficacy much quicker when you drop rates as rates went down yesterday, because the wealth effect happened so quickly and just puts anyone in this this wonderful mood when assets are going. I think that even people who don't own stocks get in a better mood when the stock market's rallying. And that's just a thumbnail theory by me. But I think that the reaction function on that side happens a lot quicker, if that makes any sense. But anyway, I think we're in a pretty decent spot right now.
Certainly your bosses are walking around happier. I mean, they're smiling.
No,
I mean, they might not have money in the stock market, but they do. And they're walking around smiling. That makes your life a little bit better.
And they may give you a raise because of it, right?
Exactly. Yeah. But making money, profits will improve. Profits improve when rates come down and when inflation comes down. Profits improve. You see a little bit of a profit improvement when inflation starts to go up, because there's pricing power and people price in advance, and they it's a little bit of gouging thing. But anyway, that's not good for the long term. Jim, I have a mortgage, and here's one quick note. Jim said, you get 2.5%, you take a mortgage. You take a mortgage at 2.5%. I have a mortgage. It's a 2.25%. It's a 2.25%. I got it in the end of summer 1991. It's fixed for 10 years on a 30-year amortization. And when they told me that was the rate, I said, okay, can I get a little more money? I actually expanded the thing. So when people give me a lot of crap about, hey, Farr's a rich guy. Yeah. And I always look back. I don't tell them exactly about the rates, but I go, yeah, Farr's a rich guy. But, Farr has a mortgage like everybody else. Okay. I got a mortgage. I could pay it off, but I'm not about to at 2.25%. Are you kidding me?
Something funny about that is that my wife handles all the bills. My wife is extremely smart. She's a successful attorney, but she doesn't really think too much about the same things we do. And she handles all the bills. And there's one day she's sitting at her desk and she's like, she goes, oh yeah, I give an extra payment to the mortgage every month. And for me, it was like, no. And I reached
across.
Pay anything else off. You hold on to that 2.5 like grim death. But it was funny. She was like, oh, that does make sense. So now we're not paying off our mortgage. We're holding on to that.
Well, so some of this is very counterintuitive. And that's why I wanted to mention it when Jim said it, because what I've been able to do is take that money from that mortgage at 2.25%, put it in treasury bills. So I'm borrowing the money from the bank at 2.25%. It's over in 6 months treasury bills at 5.4%. So I'm taking their money, thank you very much, and I've got it over in treasury bills and I'm making 3% net. Well, and then there's always some wise ass who goes, well, you're gonna have to pay tax on that. I'll pay tax on it. So I'm paying them 10%, 2%, and I'm netting 2% for me. How's that? Is that any good? It's free money.
It's a good trade, exactly.
I mean, geez, I had a young man ask me the other day about contributing to his 401k. And he said he didn't understand how it worked. And I said, what will they match? He said, 4%. I said, great. Would you like to double? How much are you making? $60,000. That's great. $60,000. That's great. So 4% is $2,400. Yes. Is it, I guess, Mr. Farr? I said, yes, it's $2,400, $60,000, 4%. That's it, $2,400. They're offering to give you another $2,400. You want it or no?
I'll take it if you don't.
They're offering to give you $2,400. You want to take it? Max out to your 401k, folks. At least max out to the match. Max out to the match. Do yourself a favor. So, Jim, coming into year end, we're out of time here. We're seeing the Santa Claus rally. Does it continue? Are things, markets are making new all-time highs. You're still suspecting recession. Do you buy this market in here? What are you doing?
Here's the only reason I'm going to say yes, I do, is because, and this might be a little too wonky, but they're giving away options. I have the VIX chart in front of me, which is trading about 12, meaning options volatility is very cheap. So for me, the price protection in for my long positions is very, very easy to do. I know most of the people who are listening don't do options. So
Fred and Ethel, Fred and Ethel have no idea what you're talking about. And frankly, I don't want them to go and start figuring it out.
I'm sorry. Then scratch that from this whole thing.
No, it's a really good point. It's a really good point. Jim has opportunities and is a sophisticated investor. He has ways to hedge around it. What would you tell Fred and Ethel?
I will say this, is that every year, I think you should evaluate everything you hold and decide what your risk tolerance is. Now, this year has been a good year, a much better than expected year for stocks. If you look at your portfolios, and this is what I do, again, I always say if I don't know you, I don't try not to give advice to you. But what I do is I look at the risk assets I hold and say, do I have too many now? This is the end of the year. It's the perfect time to do it. And then I dial back. And it's so funny is that sometimes I'm so, so bullish, but the discipline of rebalancing has to happen because I'll be bullish and then I'll be like, I'll rebalance. And then, oh, I was wrong. You know, but that I was right because the rebalancing was the right thing to do. So if you have to, you got to know what your risk tolerance is. And if you're sleeping easy is a very, very important thing.
Very important thing. And it's very important to rebalance and do it on some regular basis. We use year end. It's a bit artificial, but we can use it. I have my top 10 list for 2024 coming out in the next couple of weeks. We're going to have it on CNBC. They've already scheduled me. They're going to then release. They keep this embargoed. That's what the media calls it. They keep FAR's list embargoed right up to the last minute. When I go on the air, they'll publish it on the website, all 10 of my names. Hey, 2023 names, underperformed. I'm still not at all unhappy that I owned them. I was surprised with some of the ones that didn't perform well. I was actually surprised with the ones that were some of my good leaders, but it underperformed. The S&P is a benchmark. Still made money. Okay with that. Let's take a look at this list. They don't always beat. They do beat. They do underperform. But it's a good solid list for me, I think. And I own it every year. Every year I got to
get it. Can I ask a question about the list? I know it's top secret and whatever, but are banks represented on it with the steepening of the yield curve? And is oil something that's on it or no?
And we're going to have to wait to see.
Okay. How about it? Yeah.
We'll wait to see. These are big cap names. Most every one of them has a bit of a dividend and, I'll hold it for the whole year. And this is now a pretty significant portfolio that I dump into this thing every year because I've been doing it every year for a long time. So it's starting to be a decent chunk of money. All right, Jim Murio, thank you so much. God bless you and keep you. If I don't talk to you, Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, and Happy New Year. And we hope to spend more time with you in 2024 if I don't see you before year end.
Also, thank you too, Michael. Merry Christmas to you too, and to your producer, Harry. Thanks for everything you guys do. You do a lot.
Thank you. And I'm on your podcast coming up next week. So we'll see you there.
Oh, outstanding. That's really cool.
Yeah, that's really cool for me. We're going to come back, ladies and gentlemen, with Dan Mahaffey and then Jenny Harrington, all on a terrific FARcast for you this week. Please stay with us.
Thank you for joining us this week on the FARcast. Now it's time for political analyst Dan Mahaffey and your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back. Joining us now, Dan Mahaffey from the Center for the Study of the Presidency and Congress, our senior political analyst for the FARcast, now in season seven. Coming into the end of the year, Dan Mahaffey, welcome back. We are December the 14th. Got a couple of weeks left in 2023. Can't believe it. The year's gone by. Just gone. The summer went by. I'm still trying to remember what I did in August. And the fall's gone and everything else. So we're going to be saying this in March really soon. Dan, it's been a big year. A lot of unexpected. But I guess as we see one constant, I'd have to point to the venom in Washington has stayed constant through the year through Speaker McCarthy, now with Speaker Mike. And I guess this looks like there's no showing signs of abatement at any point.
Well, yes, as befits the season, if we were talking about them getting along, there's going to be a lot of coal in stockings in a few days here. So, no love lost on Capitol Hill, not the holiday cheer, although look, it seems to be the time of year where folks, at least the staffers, they're getting out to the holiday parties. You get a lot of that still going on in Washington, bouncing back since the pandemic. But among the members themselves and what we're getting done, very little, a lot getting kicked to next year. Circle back after the holidays. It's not just something you put in your emails. It's what the legislators are doing right now.
Well, they leave today. So Congress leaves today, and there's been no movement on what happens on the border, the southern border in the U.S. There's been no progress really on funding, any more funding for Ukraine or Israel. The president seemed to take on a more critical tone of Israel. Was that event-driven or politically driven, Dan?
Oh, it's event-driven. I think you even see over the past couple of weeks, starting with Secretary of Defense Austin at the Reagan Forum out in California, language where you see the administration clearly becoming uncomfortable with how far Israel is going and the extent to which these humanitarian corridors or ceasefires have collapsed. So a lot of concern about the administration, about how the Israelis have continued to push beyond what they said they would have done. And a lot of this, too, is concern about what is being driven by Israeli domestic politics in terms of how far Netanyahu's going.
I heard that, and I heard the president, and I hear people react around the world. And okay, Dan, now look, I'm not the political guy, but as I sit and listen to it all, I'm thinking, oh, come on. Who is surprised really by this? Israel said they were going to go in and flatten the place. Did anybody really think that they weren't going to go in and flatten the place? I mean, I understand truly the humanitarian tragedy involved. I understand what's going on. But all I'm saying is, did they not think Israel was going to do this? Is anybody really surprised that Israel's doing this, is my question for you.
No, I think there's questions, though, of there's no surprise. But then the question becomes, well, will Israel do this with a blank check from us?
And I think so far we're saying you're not going to get a blank check from us. How much pushback do they get from other countries around the world, Iran in particular, coming to the aid of Hamas? And does this escalate?
Well, I think you see it not escalating too much further, but despite what you see with the Houthis and others, the Iranians and the Israelis, look, the wild card continues to be Hezbollah. I don't see either side, though, having the, from the military capability sense, the ability to escalate much further right now. But again, that doesn't excuse the stupid political choices of escalating it further.
Yeah, well, never underestimate the ability to make yet an additional stupid political choice anyway. But I will tell you that my heart continues to break for innocents in the region, and I don't care about where the borders are. I don't care about what side of the border. When innocent lives are lost, it breaks my heart. And these conflicts, so many of them are just so senseless. And the way this started was so senseless. Anyway, all right, we'll move on. Do you have any insights for us, Dan? And are we going to be watching this 6 months from now and a year from now? Are we going to still be talking about Israel fighting and bombing in Hamas?
I think we will in some ways. I think the conflict will settle much more into an insurgency rather than what you've seen now as the Israelis try and take control, because there's no clear political plan for what to do with this territory afterwards. The Israeli ambassador to the UK today was rejecting a two-state solution. So if the Netanyahu government is rejecting a two-state solution and believes that it can somehow govern the Palestinians like this, you're not going to have any kind of peace. You're going to have a low-level insurgency-type conflict going on for quite a while, and even more violence among far-right settlers and Palestinians.
Yep. All right. Dan, we look back to the U.S., and there was a vote along party lines to impeach or pursue impeachment proceedings against President Biden. Why did that happen? How did they get 100% of Republicans to go along with this? Will this change the focus of the election? Does this make Joe Biden less electable going forward against Donald Trump?
They got Republicans and to go along with this unanimously because this, I would say, was as much an institutional vote as a partisan vote. You open the impeachment proceeding simply because the White House was refusing to give any of the documents over to the investigative committees. Now, on the other hand, this impeachment continues to be one that I don't see getting much traction beyond the usual media outlets that have long focused on the Biden family and these scandals. And look, these are scandals. You do have some issues, certainly with people dealing with addiction of all kinds, drugs, physical addictions, misbehavior, but nothing that really rises to the level yet of what has been seen as a smoking gun of criminal behavior by the president or corruption. Certainly, everyone has had can relate to a family member perhaps who's late in paying back a loan, but nothing of this seems like a Chinese government paying into the Biden family. So none of these things are being clear yet. But what you do see is this as a point where the Republicans in Congress felt they needed to open it to legitimize the proceedings, to get these documents. And what you're getting now is a lot of the same back and forth. It's kind of like a game of Mad Libs. You can just erase the past Trump impeachment proceedings, fill in the same talking points for this one. And maybe at the end of the day, that's what tells you it's sad, because something I think the founders intended to be a pretty high gravity political moment is being cheapened again and again.
So, Dan, you're a very reasonable fella in my estimation. You give it to me down the middle. Should this have happened? Is there a real problem here? It seems that there is indeed some sort of, real legal issue with the president's son.
Okay, have this vote to open the investigation, but don't do it with the fanfare you think you're doing it, and do so very carefully, because you risk over-promising. Over-promising an effect against the Bidens and really having a blowback before an upcoming election. And two, you again, I go back to cheapening something that I think the authors of our Constitution intended to be a pretty serious threshold.
So what I'm wondering is, and I'm hearing you say, this may not be a mistake yet. They could overplay their hand. But this isn't totally unreasonable, given the lack of documents.
Yes, look, I'll sum it up. Look, you're sitting down to play poker. I'm looking at you saying, look, are you sure you really want to be playing poker? I'll let you sit down at the table, but don't think you're going to get a great hand.
You're not going to get a great hand. And then this goes nowhere through the Senate. So this really doesn't have any teeth. This is a procedural. But can they create enough noise with this?
They hope they create enough noise that they paint Biden with corruption by association. And I think that's why you saw the president's son speaking so passionately yesterday when asked to testify and not doing so in deposition, but asking to do so publicly. So I think that continues to be a election distraction in ways. But I also think that part of this is done because you had Republicans were going to be asked by some of their base voters in the coming months, what have you accomplished? And they needed this impeachment as something to say that they've accomplished among their priorities.
So I read this morning that this actually will longer term could be a blow to President Biden's reelection campaign and actually advantage Trump. Yes or no?
Look, it's something the president doesn't want to deal with among the other headlines. I don't know for the average voter how much, though, this fits in among much of the other political noise that they get right now.
Okay. Finally, let's just end up on to touch on Ukraine and China for me before we're going to have another forecast or two before year end. One of them's just going to be the top 10 coming out. But I think we'll hear from Dan again before year end. But tell us what you think here. China and Ukraine, Putin, everything else. Where we go with funding, where we go with the border.
Right. I think a lot of this stuff again gets kicked until next year because they're leaving town. They're not going to do much more than the Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA. Putin thinks he's winning right now. He talks about the deadlock in Congress and talks about that as being in his favor. The Russians think they can outlast and outconscript the Ukrainians through the winter. And the Europeans now are scrambling, for better or worse, to build their own capabilities to deal with this. In China, Xi Jinping still trying to figure out how to deal with the economic difficulties that he faces, the continual disappointment we see from the markets.
That Farr would tell you he largely created for himself. He only has himself to blame.
He does really only have himself to blame. And that's, I think, going to be when people finally realize that there's not going to be the stimulus because this is the economy he wants. He doesn't want a dynamic enterprise economy. He wants a statist manufacturing economy, and that's where he's pushing China towards.
Right, which is stupid. Well, I'm going to have,
this is how Michael got hauled away for re-education through labor.
It's just absolutely stupid to say I'm going to have limits. I'm going to limit my economy so that I can have it the way I want it. Let's not have the best one. Let's not have the best economy.
Michael, I'm disappointed.
Let's not have the strongest economy.
You are displaying disharmonious thought in relation to the
disciplined economy
of Xi Jinping thought.
There's a reason I don't live in China.
You're being disharmonious, Michael.
I'm being disharmonious. And actually, but you know, the part that's not disharmonious is if China would listen to me, China would be even stronger, and they are remaining weaker because of Xi Jinping's philosophical choices over the practical economic choices. So I'm sorry, Mr. Premier, Mr. President Xi Jinping, listen, this is dumb. This is just dumb. And you're impaling yourself on your own sword.
As our petite Corsican friend said.
The other side says, keep it up. I'm not going to interrupt you while you're making stupid mistakes.
Exactly.
What else, Dan?
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays, Dan. Merry Christmas to you and yours. I hope you have a wonderful time with your family in Chicago. And thanks from all of us at the Farcast. And thank you on behalf of all of our listeners for all the wisdom and insight and really intelligent perspective you continue to provide year after year. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you, Michael. Always a joy to have these conversations with you, our other guests. And thank you, Harry, for keeping all the trains on the tracks. And
It ain't easy. Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to come back with Jenny Harrington from Gilman Hill, CNBC contributor, my dear friend, when we come back on the Farcast. Please stay with us.
Michael Farr and the Farcast are proud to support Heroes, Inc. Heroes supports the spouses and children of law enforcement officers and firefighters who gave their lives in the line of duty to the greater Washington, D.C. community. Their singular goal is to honor the supreme sacrifice made by these individuals by caring for their families. Heroes' work begins within 24 hours of the tragic loss and continues indefinitely. We invite you to learn more about Heroes' mission at heroes.org. We hope that you will consider supporting Heroes as they endeavor to honor those who protect us. That's heroes.org. Heroes, here for you, here for good. And now, back to the Farcast and your host, Michael Farr. We hope you're enjoying this week's edition of the Farcast. Please share us with friends and colleagues. And now, back to your host, Michael Farr.
Welcome back to the Farcast. I am Michael Farr. This is a guy, Harry, I'm loving this Farcast today. Jim Murio, Dan Mahaffey, and now I get to talk to Jenny Harrington. I mean, this is a great day to be Michael Farr, ladies and gentlemen, to get to talk to all these smart people and learn so much. Jenny Harrington, CEO at Gilman Hill Investments, a CNBC contributor, the co-chair, no, you're not, your vice chair of the Sibley Hospital Investment Committee with me, and a terrific friend of mine. Welcome back, Jenny.
Thanks for having me.
Jenny, we've got the 10-year Treasury below 4%. Jay Powell and the committee are suggesting maybe three cuts. making money cheaper as we go forward into 2024 and into 2025. They don't see any signs of reversal or tightening. It looks like a big slow roll. Markets go nuts yesterday. Everything's up. S&P's nearing new highs. I mean, the all-time highs. Again, Dow 37,000. For those that watch the Dow, I still watch the Dow. Used to watch it certainly as a kid. Listen to my Rukeyser. Do you know that I was a contributor on Wall Street Week, that I did that show for years, there with Lou and the elves and the orange chair and the everything? That was a hoot. And the scariest, look, being on CNBC as a guest host on Squawk Box the first time I did that, that took a couple of minutes of agita to get used to. Walking into Owings Mill, Maryland, and seeing that set and that chair and Lou Rukeyser, I mean, I was scared to death. I really was, but I got through it. Jenny, I'm sorry. How are you? What are you thinking about markets? And I'm sorry you never got on that show, because Rukeyser would have loved you.
In a way, I kind of did. And it goes back to you saying, like, you know, 10 years below 10%, market was up. I was going to say, I didn't see that coming. And I was going to reference when I interned for Laszlo Borini, how nobody sees it coming. Now, a side note, when I interned for Laszlo Borini in 1993, I think it was summer of 93.
Yeah, and you were six.
No, probably 96. I think it was the summer of 96. He actually tucked me and another intern into his Porsche. I sat on that tiny little back bench, and we drove down to Owings Mills to watch him film with Lou Rukeyser.
Was that the crappiest studio you've ever been in for TV studios? It was awful.
See, I was like 19 and a half, right? So, or 20 years. I was so young. So all I remember, I can't even do math. I was born in 1975, but this was probably 96. So I was 21. Okay. So I was 21. It's weird. I feel like it was younger. But I just thought it was so cool. And in my memory, it's all just so cool that I would have no idea if it was a crappy studio. But Laszlo had us do this project. It was amazing. It was formative. It really changed my life. And what the project was he had all the interns go back and look at the top 120 market strategists and technicians. And he kept these amazing books. And they were called clippings. And he was a voracious reader, and he would just read, 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 cut out articles, toss them in the basket, make the interns put them into books every quarter. So you could go back and kind of get the flavor of the market over that quarter by his clippings. You could also see what the strategists and technicians were saying. So in 1996, we went back to 1976 and pulled out everything everyone said, what Ralph Acampora said, what Barton Biggs said, what Abby Joseph Cohen said. And we had a technology intern, because nobody knew how to use PowerPoint back then. And he had a separate page for each one of those strategists and technicians, and track what they said versus the Dow. And what you saw was that even the very best of them were wrong all the time. So it's interesting, because I didn't see the 10-year going under 4% coming. You know, I didn't see the market explosion yesterday coming. I didn't see what we were talking about on our investment committee call earlier. I didn't see the broadening out of this rally happening to the extent that it did. Month to date, the S&P is up 3%. Equal weighted index is up 4.8. That's a really big deal. I didn't see any of that coming. And one thing I know is I never see it coming. I'm always wrong. And you know what? Everyone's always wrong. And you know what you do when you're always wrong? You stay invested, because you know, and I should say that a little differently. You're always wrong in the short term. But in the long term, as professional investors, we know staying invested wins, the market trends upwards. Bear markets, corrections, those are short-lived. Expansions, bull markets, those are long-lived. So I actually had a fantastic day yesterday, you know, not only emotionally, but monetarily. Why? Because even though I didn't see any of it coming, I was fully invested throughout, knowing that this is a really long game. So thanks to Laszlo Borini for establishing that in my head so long ago.
Oh my God, you wrapped it. You brought it all the way around back to Laszlo Borini. Very well done. That was awesome.
I'm getting good at this game.
You ought to be on TV. Oh, yeah, wait.
I am.
I saw Ralph Acampora last week.
You did? Nice, he's amazing.
He is the best. I told him so, too. I was so glad to see Ralph. This was at a conference in Sarasota where I spoke with Kenny Polcari and Liz Ann Saunders, and he was there and had a nice chat with him. Hadn't seen him for years. I think he's 82 now and still working. I mean, but sort of. Anyway, he's.
Can we go on to Ralph Acampora since we're like digressing into fantastic.
Ralph Acampora, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, very famous technician. And as I told him, I thought he was the best technician on Wall Street for years, reading charts. And we're the only guy, the only technician year after year and month after month or week after week. If Ralph Acampora came out to make a statement about what he saw as some big change happening technically in the markets, I'm telling you, I turned off everything, shut the door and listened and got the report from somewhere and would read it religiously. Ralph was as good as it ever got.
Yeah. So here's when I met Ralph Acampora. I had amazing internships. And this was before anyone interned. This is when you just got a summer job. But I really, you know, I went to Hollins College down in Virginia. I knew I wasn't getting a job on Wall Street right out of Hollins unless I paved that road myself. So I interned
At Hollins, at Hollins University, you were Phi Beta Kappa, were you not?
I was. Thank you.
Yeah, I thought Phi Beta Kappa. Yeah, another one of those dumb kids from Hollins University, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, sure. But you know what I mean. Like the Ivy, back then when I started at Goldman in 1997, like the entire analyst class was Ivy. There were three of us who weren't. That's where all the recruiting was done. So it really was hard to get a job if you weren't Ivy back then. I was taking a crack on the recruiting, not the intelligence. But so I made a point to intern. And I found an internship at a firm called Keefe Managers, which was founded by Harry Keefe, who had started Keefe, Brett and Woods, retired and started a bank and thrift stock hedge fund. So here I am, right? And this is 1994. This is amazing. So I'm at this point, I'm actually 19. And this is one of my most important and first forays into Wall Street. And Keefe was amazing. They kind of like punched above their weight. They had incredible access. And Ralph came in to talk to us. And of course, as an intern, I got to join that. And this is as I recall the story, so it might be a little rusty, but as I recall, he'd taken a sabbatical and he'd actually kind of like stepped away for, I don't know how long it was. I don't know if it was a year or 6 months, but he'd really stepped away to collect his thoughts and just thought and studied and read. And he came back and he said at this point, I'm pretty sure it was down 9,000. And he kind of went on this like campaign of down 9,000. And everyone thought he was insane. And I remember him being in Keefe Managers and, you know, I didn't know any better. I didn't have any context for him saying down 9,000 and how outrageous that was. But I remember him leaving and Harry Keefe, and it was a really compelling, like, here's why the market's going significantly higher. Here's these structural forces behind it. This is incredible. And I remember him leaving and Harry Keefe and the portfolio manager saying, you know, most people are making fun of what he's saying right now, but this is legit. And he's really on to something and he's right. And it was super interesting. And you know what? He was right. He was more right than anybody.
Jenny, what do you make of stock prices here? I agree with you. When we talked to Jim Murio this morning and I said, you know, how many of the economists out there and how many of the strategists are continuing to say, but I still think we're going to have a recession in the first half. I'm still hearing it. He said, and I'm still saying it, which I give him great credit. He said, I've been wrong for months now. I said, I've been wrong for years now. But these rates, persistent rates, if they don't do anything for the next 6 months, I believe are still sufficient to cause enough of a slowdown, whether, you know, you call it a recession or not a recession, but even the Fed saying 1.25%, 1.5% GDP growth, substantially slower than the past couple of years. How do you look at that? What are you thinking about stocks and discipline, and what should we be telling to Fred and Ethel?
Okay, so one thing, correction, it was down 12,000, not down 9,000 back then. And that was really audacious. Okay, so with respect to recession, my partner Greg said something really interesting. And he's like, look, you know, if GDP growth is like plus 0.2% or minus 0.2%, it doesn't really matter, right? But if it's minus 0.2%, we're in a recession. I think it's really the magnitude. If we whether I think next year's all about magnitude. And I think it's kind of lackluster. I don't see anything. And don't forget my, you know, my opening, I always get it wrong. So stay invested. But I don't see anything compelling out there. I don't see robust GDP growth. I don't see things really crumbling and falling apart. I think the American consumer, even though they're having significant reductions to their disposable income, they're still spending. You know, you don't bet against America, you don't bet against the US consumer. So I think there's a pretty decent foundation. I think seeing interest rates coming down and thinking about people's interest expenses decreasing and actually, you know, deflation setting in, that kind of keeps the disposable income at a decent level. Not great. I don't see anything compelling either way next year. And when we think about the market overall, and this is what I struggle with so much, especially this year, is we're always talking about the S&P 500, even though most of us aren't really invested in the S&P 500, because we all know, you know, it's 30% in 8 stocks that have pretty stretched valuations given what their earnings growth are. So most people aren't in the S&P 500. So when we think about next year, I do not see any way that the market, the S&P 500, goes faster. And that's just to me a mathematical equation. The expectations right now are for $250 earnings next year. That would imply 11% earnings growth year over year. You put a 19 times multiple on that, gets you to 4,700 on the S&P 500. That's where we are. So that's kind of a best case scenario. I don't even think we're going to get $250 of earnings. I don't even think that we're going to get 19 times multiple, or we don't deserve a 19 times multiple. So I don't see how the market goes up. But a comment that I made earlier, we see the market broadening out. When you look at things like the portfolio that I manage, which is a dividend income strategy, it trades at a forward multiple of 12 times. When you look overseas at international stocks, they trade at a significantly large discount to their U.S. counterparts. Many of them have the same growth rates. If you look at small cap, it's trading at unprecedented for 30 years valuation gap to the broader market. There's all sorts of places to invest, but I really think that the playbook that's worked in terms of being large cap, S&P, floating along with the market, that's got to change, particularly next year. I think we got a little bit of a breather this year, although if you take it over the last 2 years, market's flat. So it's not as compelling as it seems.
One cautionary tale. I agree with everything that you just said, and it was brilliantly said. One cautionary tale: back in the 70s, we had the Nifty 50 that got up to 50 times earnings, and the small caps were trading at 8 and 9 times earnings. And everybody looked up and said, look at this gap. You can't have this. Everybody's got to buy the small caps now. And many people did, because that gap had to close. Indeed, it closed. The Nifty 50 came down to about 8 or 9 times earnings. The small caps really didn't move much, so you didn't get killed. But for all of the data that can be historically perfect, the prospective outcome always has a way, going to Jenny's opening line about how smart people like Jenny and somewhat intellectually challenged people like myself continue to be surprised. That's how. You look at the data, you look at the history, you say, oh, okay, this is what's happened before, it should happen again, and then it doesn't, and then it just doesn't. And then you look back in a couple of months and say, oh, I see what happened there. So that will likely happen again. If you're going to listen to one thing from Jenny and one thing from Jim Murio today, curb your enthusiasm from Jenny and go through your year-end discipline from Jim Murio. This is the time of year when most people meet with their advisors and say, is my equity position appropriate for my time in life, for my financial goals? Take a look, reevaluate. If there's some changes that need to be made, do it in a tax-sensitive way. Do it in a thoughtful way. Never any reason to do much urgently in the markets or with investing, in Farr's opinion, if you're doing it properly. Jenny Harrington, can't thank you enough for being with us on the Farrcast, for all of your wisdom all year. We wish you and your family the happiest of holidays. Happy and healthy and blessed and profitable 2024. And we hope we get to see a lot more of you in 2024. It'll make it a better year for all of us and all of our Farrcast listeners.
Thanks, Michael.
That's it for another Farcast, ladies and gentlemen, as we cover Wall Street, Washington, and the world. We'll be back again next week trying to bring you some of the leading experts in the nation and from around the world to provide insights and thought leadership and help you understand your world and your investing a little bit better. For Harry Jennings, our producer, everybody at Farr Miller in Washington and Hightower Advisors, can't tell you how grateful I am. Please share us on your social media. I'm Michael Farr. See you next week.
That's a wrap for this week's episode of the Farcast. Thanks for joining us this week. Please share with friends and colleagues. And thanks to our guest, Jim Urio, Dan Mahaffey, and special guest, Jenny Harrington. The Farcast is produced by Michael Farr and Harry Jennings and comes to you weekly on all major podcast platforms, including Google, Spotify, TuneIn, and Apple Podcasts. You can stream past episodes as well as subscribe so you never miss a new one. Please be aware that anytime we or any of our guests mention a specific company, sector, or refer to performance in relation to an earnings report, news headline, or economic trend, it is not a recommendation to buy or sell. Review the risks and rewards of any investment with your financial advisor for what specific investment and general strategy is appropriate for you before you make any investment decision. And as always, we can be of assistance at Farr Miller in Washington. Please reach out to me at hjennings@farrmiller.com. We are here to help, and I am happy to arrange for any of our listeners an appointment with one of our financial professionals to review your portfolio, your needs, and your goals. If you have any questions about past episodes or questions you'd like us to answer in upcoming shows, please feel free to reach out. We love reading all of your notes, and we try to reply to as many as we can. You can email me at hjennings@farrmiller.com. Take care, stay safe, and stay healthy. We'll be back with you next week on the Farcast. Wall Street, Washington, and the world. Farr Miller in Washington is a group comprised of investment professionals registered with Hightower Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor. Some investment professionals may also be registered with Hightower Securities, LLC, member FINRA and SIPC. Advisory services are offered through Hightower Advisors, LLC. Securities are offered through Hightower Securities, LLC. All information referenced herein is from sources believed to be reliable. Farr Miller in Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC have not independently verified the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Farr Miller in Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC, and any of its affiliates make no representations or warranties, expressed or implied, as to the accuracy or completeness of the information or for statements or errors or omissions or results obtained from the use of this information. Farr Miller in Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC, and any of its affiliates assume no liability or any action made or taken in reliance on or relating in any way to the information. This podcast and the materials contained herein were created for informational purposes only. The opinions expressed are solely those of the authors and do not represent those of Hightower Advisors, LLC, or any of its affiliates. Farr Miller in Washington and Hightower Advisors, LLC, or any of its affiliates do not provide tax or legal advice. This material was not intended or written to be used or presented in any way to any entity as tax or legal advice. Clients are urged to consult their tax and/or legal advisors for related questions.